Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Adam Keawe Manalo Camp. He's a Hawaiian cultural historian as well as the president of Indigenous Pacifica. He is also a published writer, blogger, podcaster, researcher, and administrator of the Facebook group Hawaiian History and Culture, which is the largest history group on Facebook with more than 27,000 members. In addition, he's currently the secretary and outreach coordinator for Affirmative Action Committee of the Democratic Party of Hawaii. He is of Kanaka Mauli, Native Hawaiian, and Filipino, Ilocano, and Kalinga ancestry. So, first, thank you for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, there is some conflict going on right now over a planned telescope. Can you talk about that?
Sure. But before we get into the 10-meter telescope, the TMT telescope issue, I think that maybe for your audience, it would be great if they had some background history on Hawaii.
That's great. Please.
So, prior to, most people think of Hawaii as the 50th state. Most people don't know how we got to that point. So Hawaii, for about 2,000 years, was ruled by the Kanaka Maoli people. And in about 1810, Kamehameha I conquered the four major Hawaiian kingdoms, unified the country, and we became the Hawaiian Kingdom. And the Hawaiian Kingdom was recognized by all the major powers of the world. We had a constitution. We had an elected parliament. We were a constitutional monarchy. In 1893, we had Queen Liliʻuokalani. She was actually a feminist. She was very progressive in her thinking for that time period. She believed in things like women should have the right to vote. People should not be restricted by property in order to hold political office. And there was this thing that the United States didn't particularly like, which was she was against the cession of Pearl Harbor to the United States as part of a reciprocity treaty. So she ran into problems, and a group of mostly American expatriates living in Hawaii and who owned a large chunk of Hawaii's economy, we can say that they were the 1% of their time, with the assistance of the United States Naval Forces in the islands, overthrew the constitutional government of Queen Liliʻuokalani, established a puppet regime that was based on the apartheid regimes of Rhodesia and, of course, in the Deep South. And in 1900, Hawaii was made into a organized territory of the United States. This all happened while the Native Hawaiian people, the Kanaka Maoli people, protested and they resisted. Most Native Hawaiians at the time did not want to become part of the United States. Now, when the United States took over Hawaii formally as a territory, it took possession of the crown lands, lands that belonged to the institution of the Hawaiian monarchy. These lands amounted to about 1.3 million acres, and these include most of the military bases in Hawaii today. Hawaii has over 173 military installations. And this was all done without any compensation to either the monarchy or to the Hawaiian people. And we referred to these lands as ceded lands because they were ceded by the puppet regime to the United States as part of annexation. So what had happened through the course of from 1921 until 1959 with statehood, the United States entered into a compact-like relationship with the Native Hawaiian people where it promised that it would earmark about 210,000 acres for Native Hawaiian resettlement called the Hawaiian Homelands. Now, Mauna Kea itself is actually ceded land. It is land that was stolen by the United States upon annexation. And some of these lands that are being used are also part of the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. the department that's supposed to oversee the settlement of Hawaiians on their ancestral lands. So this conflict has deep roots in our history and in the way the land is managed here. For Native Hawaiians, we in general see the land as not as property, because traditionally we didn't have property, but as something that sustains us. We have a deep spiritual relationship to the land. And if I may, there's something in that you had wrote before in one of your works on the supremacy of man that actually dovetails into the Hawaiian spiritual thought or philosophy of land and our relationship to the land. In the Western view, land is to be dominated by man. It's real estate, it's property. In the Hawaiian worldview, traditionally, as in the Kumulipo, our creation, or actually it's a genealogical chant to creation, nature, and therefore the land, was here before mankind existed. And because of that, there is a certain amount of inherent spirituality within the land, and the land is not something that we can dominate. It's something that is kind of akin to an older sibling. So, going back to the TMT, or the 10-meter telescope, so back in the 1960s, the University of Hawaii began to build a series of telescopes. Originally, they were supposed to be limited to 3 telescopes. And what had happened was, in the 1970s, there was a telescope boom, and they built over 13 telescopes. And the state of Hawaii, instead of doing something about it, gave the University of Hawaii permits for the telescopes, even though they didn't get permits before they built the telescopes. So there's that issue. The University of Hawaii has not been a very good steward of Mauna Kea, and the Hawaiian people have not been consulted with the telescopes in the first place, particularly the last 10 telescopes. And there has been issues with pollution. There was a mercury spill that happened and that infected one of our lakes up there at Mauna Kea, Lake Waiau. And Hawaiians since the 1980s have actually been protesting UH's management of the telescopes, as well as the entire mountain. And we have also been protesting the way that Hawaiian homelands has not been distributed to Native Hawaiians. Actually, from 1921 until now, there's a waiting list of over 24,000 people, Native Hawaiians, who are qualified for Hawaiian homestead that have not received homestead lots. So back in the late 1990s, UH held a series of public meetings about building this gigantic 18-story telescope, the TMT, the 10-meter telescope. And a majority of the testimony by Native Hawaiians were actually against it because of how UH has treated the mountain itself. And despite the opposition, the state allowed the plan to proceed. And a group of people, the Kia'i, the protectors of Mauna Kea, formed in about 2015 when construction was originally planned, and began to take over the access road. And there was an agreement back in 2015 that the Kia'i would go to the Supreme Court to have some sort of justice, but the Supreme Court ended up ruling in favor of UH. So then this year, the Kaili returned and blocked the access again. So tentatively, the construction has been postponed for 2 years. In the meantime, there's been a community that has formed at the access road at the base of the mountain. They have free healthcare, free education programs. They're existing as a community.
So this, what I hear you saying is that this is sort of an unbroken chain of at least of almost 200 years of continued expansion of control by the settler society and resistance by the Hawaiian community, and this is merely one flashpoint of that long tradition. Is that right?
That's correct. That's absolutely right.
And I'm a little bit okay. So can we go back and fill in a couple details? Your history
sure.
was really great, and a couple questions I had was when you said the amount of land that was so let's back up to the coup.
Okay.
And how much what is the landmass of Hawaii of the that Hawaiian kingdom? And then I'm sorry, I don't know what I'm trying to get at. That it sounds, just take this wherever you want, with either what percentage of the landmass was immediately stolen, or
mm-hmm.
how much was stolen. And you also talked about these oligarchs taking land, and here's what I'm trying to get at is I have a friend who lives in Hawaii, and mm-hmm. she often talks about how on the island that she lives on there are basically a few rich families own a huge percentage of the island. So that's the Baldwin brothers, I believe. And so can you either talk about the conquest itself or the takeover of the economy, the history of the takeover of the economy of Hawaii by the dominant culture? That's what I'm asking.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes. Okay, so let me go back to how private property was established then in Hawaii.
Great, please.
Okay, so in 1819, upon the death of King Kamehameha I, we overthrew our Hawaiian villages system. And the following year, American Calvinist missionaries, mostly from Massachusetts, arrived.
Wait. So you said we overthrew. So was that a good thing? Was that a bad thing? And by religious system, are you talking about the relationship to the land as well? Can you talk a little bit more about that? I'm sorry.
Oh, sure. Okay. So, like any society, there's a formal religious system that's centered around the state, the government, the elite. And then there's the informal religious system that actually still exists within Hawaii. some would refer to that as the deep culture. So what had happened was in 1819, two of the widows of King Kamehameha I organized basically, how do I put it, a coup against the state religion itself and overthrew the priesthood as well as the temples. But the deep culture, which revolved around the relationship with the land and ancestral veneration, still remained. It was just the formal structure of the Hawaiian religious system that had developed over the last 500 years was overthrown. And
great.
Some people would say that was bad because it opened us up to Christianity, and some people would say that it was good because the elite, the religious elite, had been abusing their power for a while, and also there was a lot of dramatic changes that was happening in the Hawaiian society at the time. Captain Cook stumbled upon Hawaii in 1778. With him, he brought mosquitoes and diseases. And by 1819, about a third of the Hawaiian population was wiped out by disease. So the Hawaiian people were facing a population collapse in 1819. And so they began to question their society. And one of the things they began to question is whether or not this formal religious system was necessary, especially when we're having all of these foreigners that are coming in. Now, when the Hawaiian religious system was overthrown in 1819, that didn't mean that the relationship of the land changed. The king was basically the steward of the land, and he appointed minor chiefs who then acted on his behalf. And what had happened was in 1843, there was a six-month British occupation of Hawaii, and the British eventually restored Hawaiian sovereignty, and we still celebrate that holiday today, and recognized Hawaiian independence. But what had happened was, because of that occupation, that led two chiefs questioning whether or not they would be secured in their rights, and whether or not the Hawaiian people would be secured in their rights. And they felt that by adopting some of the trappings of Western property values and property systems, that no matter what would happen, at least the Hawaiians, hopefully, wouldn't become landless in their own country. So, 1845 began what's called the Great Mahele. Mahele means to divide. The Hawaiian archipelago consists of about 153 islands, but there's eight major ones. The total land mass is about 3 million acres. So a little bit more than 3 million. So what the chiefs and the king decided to do was they divided up the 3 million into thirds. So one third went to the institution of the monarchy. One third went to the chiefs, and then one third went to the common people. What's known as the Kuleana lands. And unfortunately, what had happened was the devil was in the details, and the Great Mahele turned out to be not what they had expected. In 1848, the missionaries, who by that time had been in Hawaii for over 20 years, pushed the king and the chiefs to accept certain reforms in the promise of economic development. That led to the Alien Privatization Act, which allowed non-citizens to own Hawaiian land. And since the missionaries had money, and they had the capital, and they had the connections, they ended up controlling a majority of the Kuleana lands. Within two generations. And they ended up also buying over lands that originally belonged to chiefs.
Wow, this is a story that we've just seen all across the world, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So these missionary families, they lived in a society that was very different from the rest of Hawaii. Their children were not allowed to speak Hawaiian. They attended only white schools. They formed businesses that controlled vital aspects of the Hawaiian economy, such as shipping, sugarcane, pineapple, and practically everything that was export related, they controlled. By the time that Queen Liliuokalani came to the throne, these missionary families were mostly American, controlled roughly 75% of the Hawaiian economy. And they married each other. And their companies were collectively known as the Big Five, because they controlled the five largest industries in Hawaii at the time.
So So can you talk a little bit more about, I'm sorry, I don't remember the word, but can you talk more about the creation story slash genealogy? I know you put those two together.
Yes. Okay, so in our traditions, we have what's called the Kumulipo. And usually in English, it's translated as the creation chant of the Hawaiian people. But in actuality, that's kind of a misnomer. Because there is actually no creation in the creation story. It's not like the Judeo-Christian version where there's, you know, a God that creates nature, that creates light, earth, man, and everything else like that. In the Kumulipo, it doesn't work like that. What happens is that two powerful energies are established, and they give birth to the various forms of life that we see today. And that includes the gods and man. And in the Hawaiian creation story, we recognize that the gods have three, how do I put it, aspects. There's that sacred aspect, but we also recognize that most of the gods were actually ancestral figures. They were our ancestors that became deified at some point because of what they did. And we also recognize that these stories, these gods, also embody certain psychological and natural phenomena. And with Mauna Kea, the name Mauna Kea usually is translated as White Mountain because it snows, but actually it's a shortened name for Mauna Wakea. So Wakea is the Sky Father. He's the one that him and Papa Hanaumoku, the Earth Mother, gave birth to mankind. So the mountain is named after our Sky Father, the one who created, the one who gave birth to humanity itself. And that also explains why Hawaiians are very protective about Mauna Kea. It's also believed to be the domain of Poliahu and her sisters. Poliahu is actually one of the granddaughters of, depending on which genealogy chant you're using, but she is one of the family members of Wakea, and she's also the snow goddess. And there's a lot of stories about her, and there's a lot of stories about Papa and Wakea, our ancestral, our ancestors, in connection to Mauna Kea. And before the settlers came, before Captain Cook, Mauna Kea was a site of pilgrimage. There's a lake in Mauna Kea, Lake Waiau, that's believed to be a pico, or kind of like an umbilical cord to the rest of the world. So I hope that kind of answers that question.
Yeah, thank you. And another term that you have used that seems important to this discussion and to the resistance is, and I'm sorry if I mispronounce it, Kapu Aloha?
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So Kapu Aloha is a modern term that actually grew out of the first struggle, 2015, at Mauna Kea. Now, so Kapu means sacred, and Aloha means, in this particular case, love or compassion or mercy. And it's taken from parts of different Hawaiian principles of resistance, as well as Gandhi's ahimsa, or self-discipline. And Kapu Aloha means that one restricts oneself to compassion, to trying to, not to use that, trying to emulate the change that you want to see in the world. So that means things like when you're up there at Mauna Kea, because I've been there and I've got their education programs up there. That means things like showing respect to everyone, not stealing, not drinking, not smoking, keeping your body pure. That also means if you're being trolled by someone or someone is being unkind, you show them, you still continue to maintain your compassion to them, and you adhere to nonviolent principles. And that you also show compassion to the other people who are also there on the Mauna, as well as using that as a way of disciplining yourself. Because it can be very difficult, especially in social media, where people, you know, harass you and tease you, and for a period of time, the trolling in regards to this issue was extremely bad. And Kapu Aloha was a way of people to exercise restraint. It was a way of people showing that this mountain is sacred. This mountain is something that is special to us. And we're not going to defile it in any way. We're going to show that we are Mauna Kea. We are the mountain. We are the ancestors that we would like to the people, we are the ancestors that we know we had. And we would like our children, our descendants, to be proud of us. And this Kapu Aloha also means that we will protect the mountain, non-violently, but at all costs.
Thank you for that. So why was, I'm sorry if this is a terribly naive question, but why was there so much trolling? It seems like you have the institution of University of Hawaii would be pushing it, and state and federal governments pushing it. But I mean, it's sorry to be crass, but was the trolling, was just a lot of it racist, or what was the trolling about?
Yes. Short answer, yes. So the state of Hawaii considers this an economic project and has been sending out the messaging that this is, you know, a multi-billion-dollar project that will boost the island of Hawaii's economy, and that this is needed, and that this will help the brain drain that we currently have. It'll keep our talented youth in Hawaii because they can go into astronomy and stay here. And that messaging was particularly strong in 2015. So people, particularly settlers on the island of Hawaii, was being very, how do I put it, racist about the protests. Essentially saying that these protests were going to be harming the economic well-being of the island. And so there was a lot of personal attacks. And to be perfectly fair, excuse me, not, so Kapu Aloha is not something that is or should be imposed upon all Native Hawaiians. It's just something that we would like more Hawaiians, particularly when you go to Mauna Kea itself, to follow. And there were some cases where Hawaiians just got really fed up with some of the trolling and the ways that the media was presenting this issue. That there were some instances of people just acting poorly online. And this time around, 2019, there has been none of that, from what I have seen. Ige, the governor of Hawaii, however, has been using that issue in public announcements, claiming that state officials have received death threats from the Kea'i, the protectors of Mauna Kea. And he has been very very dangerously messaging about that there's supposedly drug use up there, there's alcohol use, there's lawlessness up there, Mauna Kea, that the Kia'i, the protectors, don't have control over the thousands of people who are already camped there. And that is also reflected in some of the pro-TMT Facebook groups. And while there probably are instances of Wines acting badly online, for the most part, from what I have personally seen, being there in Mauna Kea, what Ige has been saying totally contradicts what I have seen and what I personally have heard. There's even a helpline up there in Mauna Kea. If you are being harassed by someone, another protector, or by someone on the Mauna, they have a helpline where you can call them and then they'll come and deal with the situation. There's even there's a ranger force, which is acting like a police force up there to maintain everyone. There's food services up there, providing food for the protectors for free. For some people, the commentary is that what makes the Mauna Kea, this Mauna Kea resistance particularly troubling for state officials is the fact that the Mauna Kea community has organized themselves in such a way that they are purposely being an antithesis to the way that the state is by providing free medical care, free help, free food. There's donations of clothing. There's what's called Kanaka Uber, where if you need a ride to get to the mountain, they have a line for that. Everything is very well organized, and everything is being shared by the community. And that's something that some people feel that itself kind of threatens the state, because that goes very well with Hawaiian traditions of village life, but goes very much against capitalism.
So there's a couple directions to go here. One of them is that you mentioned thousands of people, and how many people are actively participating in the resistance to this construction? And I'm going to ask the other question later, so let's just go with that one.
So the times that I have been there in Mauna Kea, there has been at least 2,000 or 3,000 people camping up there. When I mean camping, they're either having, you know, their tents or they're sleeping in their car. And there's a general rule up there. So everything is organized by a kupuna council. And kupuna means elders. And these elders were also the 35 people who were arrested earlier this year by the state for blocking the access road. And they have been doing a really superb job. Everything is, like I said, it's very well organized. I mean, it's more organized than what the state has been doing. I've been personally impressed with what they have been doing and the level of discipline that everyone up there has been having. 2 weeks ago, there was a Aloha Aina march. Aloha Aina means love of the land. Over 20,000 people participated. I also participated. I think the numbers were actually closer to 25,000. And the Aloha Aina March happened here on the island of Oahu. Mauna Kea is on the island of Hawaii, or the Big Island, which is a different island. A majority of Hawaiians, if you were here, are supportive of the protectors. They are trying to adhere to Kapu Aloha. They're participating in any way that they can, and they are going to Mauna Kea to also conduct pilgrimage, because one of the state's arguments is that Mauna Kea is no longer a sacred site, because they're using the argument that, well, you know, Hawaiians, they overthrew the religious system. So therefore, how can they argue that it's sacred anymore? But the thing is, what they don't understand is, yeah, Hawaiians overthrew the institutions, but not the actual beliefs. And many Hawaiians, even till today, practice a syncretic religion that mixes Christianity with the old religion. Most Hawaiians today still believe in venerating ancestors. They still believe in aumakua, which are... Aumakua are forms that your ancestors can reveal themselves. And these can be in the forms of animals, or clouds, or natural phenomena. Majority of Hawaiians still believe in those traditions. And since the 1970s, with the Second Hawaiian Renaissance, there has been a strong revival of the Native Hawaiian culture. And more Hawaiians are getting back into the traditional Hawaiian religion. More Hawaiians are getting back into those beliefs. More Hawaiians are learning the Hawaiian language. Because during the early part of the American occupation, the Hawaiian language was banned as a medium of public instruction in all schools. And there was a social ban on Hawaiian. So we lost about three generations of Hawaiians who were not allowed to speak Hawaiian. And for example, my grandmother, when she attended school, public school back in her time, she was literally beaten for speaking Hawaiian to one of her classmates. And that's the story of a lot of the Hawaiian kupuna, the Hawaiian elders. They were stripped of their language, they were stripped of their identity, they were told to be good Americans. And this generation, the ones who were who have lived through the Hawaiian Renaissance of the 1970s, have rejected that for the most part, and said, no, we're Hawaiians. We're always going to be Hawaiians. We need to be Hawaiian.
So you talked about those pretty big marches, and you know, I haven't seen a lot of media coverage of this. Where I first learned of this whole struggle, honestly, is my friend who lives in Hawaii. We were talking... oh gosh, 6 months or a year ago, and she happened to mention that there were lots of bumper stickers all over the island she lives on, supporting the resistance. So that, and then we started talking about that a little bit. And the point is that, so if my friend was seeing lots of bumper stickers, there seems to be a lot of popular support for the resistance. Is that true?
That is absolutely true. On my island, Oahu, which is the capital, where Honolulu is, you can go to Hawaiian neighborhoods and you can see signs, literal signs, Ku Kia'i Mauna Kea, protect Mauna Kea. And there's a lot of Hawaiian flags being displayed. Right now, one of the symbols that's being used, so there's like two symbols that are being used. There's the direct Mauna Kea symbol, which is a triangular symbol, usually in red. And then there's another symbol that we've been using, which is the upside down Hawaiian flag. And that represents that, so when a flag is turned upside down, that's the stress. And the upside down Hawaiian flag represents and has represented since, the beginning of the modern sovereignty struggle, that we are a nation that is occupied, that is in distress. And it represents our desire for freedom, for sovereignty and self-determination.
So I want to go back now to something you said a while ago about how the proponents of the telescope argue that this will bring jobs. And can you discuss for a little while the insanity of basing an economy on that serving an economy destroys land. And this is a pattern that we have literally seen across the entire world. And it's an argument we've seen across the entire world that we need to cut down the forest here because it will bring jobs. We need to build that observatory because it will bring jobs. We need to destroy this part of the desert, this part of the grasslands, this part. We need to steal this land because it will bring jobs. Can you, that was one of my first back, gosh, in the 90s. Gosh, even going back to my childhood, I understood this, that if you have an economy that is based on destroying the land, then that economy is wrong because it's going to destroy the land. I mean, can you talk about your, as a person who has a traditional and genealogical connection to an economy that was not based on land destruction, can you just take any of this sort of soup that I've just thrown at you and make something of it?
Sure. Our struggle with Manakya and our struggle with the occupation itself is very similar to the struggles of other indigenous peoples, where economic development always means building things. And building things means pumping up, you know, the economy. People need jobs. You're going to get jobs. There's this promise of jobs. And there's no thought given to people's relationship to the land, people's happiness, and the quality of life that destroying nature destroys. There's been studies on how greenery, for example, itself helps to de-stress people. But here we are, we're destroying things that ultimately help us. Now, the Hawaiian word for land is aina, and that's composed of two parts. Ai means to eat, and na is a modifier that turns a verb into a general noun. So aina means something that sustains you, and that kind of defines our relationship with the land. It needs to sustain us. And when the state or these big businesses talk about economic development, we as Native people don't see that as being sustainable. How can it be sustainable? We're going to destroy something that has been there for thousands of years, that has helped us, that literally provides oxygen, that gives us water, just so that way we can create 150 new jobs. Hawaii's economy is largely based on, right now, it's largely based on two pillars. One is the military, and the other is tourism. Now, if you go to Waikiki, Waikiki is probably one of the most unpleasant places you ever go to in Hawaii. It's basically a concrete jungle full of Prada stores and high-end retail nowadays, particularly because Japanese tourists will come here to buy luxury goods before going back to Japan, because supposedly luxury goods here, due to the way that the Japanese yen is cheaper than in Japan. So you have these high-end retail stores, you have these huge hotels in Waikiki. Most of it, I cannot think of any Native Hawaiian-owned hotel in Waikiki or any Native Hawaiian-owned restaurant in Waikiki. Most of these hotels in Waikiki today are, well, the biggest ones are owned by the Marriott Corporation. So, yeah. So, we're destroying our natural resources to bring in jobs. We're also destroying it to build hotels for tourists, even though outside of indigenous values, tourists generally come here to look because of our natural beauty and our culture. But you're destroying both of them in order to bring in more tourism. Hawaii has a major over-tourism problem, which is only now being slowly acknowledged by the state government, because we get about 10 to 12 million tourists a year, and our total resident population is about 1.2 million. This means that our residents are forced to serve the tourism industry whether we like it or not. And outside of tourism, they're tourism related service jobs. There's the military. And Hawaii has over 174 military installations. The biggest one is at Pearl Harbor. And, yeah, Pearl Harbor used to be a place where Hawaiians could gather clams and oysters, hence the name Pearl Harbor. Today, it's one of the most polluted harbors in the United States. It has nuclear facilities, and we can't fish there. We can't use anything there because it's so polluted. You cannot even swim in Pearl Harbor. It's just that polluted. So you have this economy that's built upon quote-unquote job creation that ends up destroying the economy, that ruins people's livelihoods and quality of life, not to mention displaces the native people. And that's a well-known story throughout the world.
So we just have a couple minutes left, and I'm going to throw another big one at you, but and then also a small one. I'll give you both of them. One of them is, do you want to comment on the irony of destroying something on Earth so you can learn something about outer space? And the other is, how can people across the United States or world contribute to this particular struggle and also to the struggle of the Hawaiian people in general?
Well, your first question actually reminds me of a t-shirt that's been going around, where it's in English and in Hawaiian, and the English is basically, before you look to space, you need to look at the land. And that has been a deep irony. Here they are, they're talking about looking into basically the Big Bang, looking into the beginnings of the universe on a mountain that Hawaiians regard as the beginning of humanity. And yet they can't see that relationship, and they don't want to see the relationship because they frame it as Hawaiians are just being superstitious. But it's not just superstition, but there's also a practical reality that these scientists are not missing. These telescopes have leaked before. They've leaked Mercury. And the island of Hawaii's main aquifers, the ones that provide fresh water for most of the island, are actually within the mountain. So if there is an environmental issue that happens with the TMT or any other of the telescopes, and it leaks into the aquifers, the entire island will lose its fresh water supply. And that's an issue that they don't want to talk about. And again, because job creation, right? And you can always just import what you need instead of taking care of what you have. And to answer your other question, I would wish that more people around the United States, there has been tremendous solidarity of peoples towards Mauna Kea. There has been delegations, literally from around the world, who have come to pilgrimage at Mauna Kea to pay respects to the mountain and to the kupuna. Delegations from various Native American nations, to Micronesians, to Filipinos, to people from Europe and Japan, have also come, and they rendered pilgrimage over there and offering solidarity. And there has been a lot of messages of solidarity coming from around the world, and we greatly appreciate that. And I hope that people would get more educated on the history of Hawaii and would also communicate with the main sponsors of the TMT and to the state government here of their opposition to destroying what is good about Hawaii.
Well, thank you so much for that, and thank you for the entire interview, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Adam Keawe Manalo Camp. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Mahalo for having me. Thank you.